It's great to be here. Yes, I have been searching out my ancestry. Like a lot of Australians, I have several strands that come back to Ireland, and along with the English and Scots, but the Irish seems to be the most important part. And I do have an ancestor who came from Cork, actually, a Margaret O'Driscoll, about whom I know very little, I have to say, except that she came. And I was thinking you don't know much about me either, so I thought I would read a poem that maybe fills in some of the gaps. It's called Fire. Ross Donlan was born. He is a man, a son, nephew, cousin, father. He is a reader, writer, and reality wrestler. He has degrees in dreaming, first class honours in fantasy, postgraduate work in wondering. His master's research into why has recently been expanded and upgraded into a PhD incorporating why not. He has been highly commended for not entering poetry competitions, both national and those of small country towns. He has been forcibly rejected by some of the finest literary magazines in the country, including Northerly, Southerly, Easterly, Westerly, and The Engine. His published works include, after which he self-published, this latter was praised by Seamus Heaney for its minimalism and use of space. He reads his work and is currently engaged in the major projects of being published in Northerly, Southerly, Easterly, Westerly, and The Engine. Thank you. You haven't heard of The Engine either. It's actually quite a flagship literary magazine in Australia that comes out of the University of Melbourne. It's an Aboriginal term that I think means something like gathering ground or being together, but a wicked Sydney writer said that The Engine was actually an Aboriginal term meaning rejected by the New Yorker. Next poem's called Man and Moisturiser. My skin is drying. I'm scaly as a pearly alligator, but the woman in the pharmacy is encouraging, cheerful. Tells me I can use this lotion all over my body. Then she pauses, and something occurs to her. Back home, I adopt the pose of every clown or actor I've seen spread grease paint over stubble, or every woman I've watched tilt a chin, furrow a tongue, then rolled an eye at a mirror to better see a spread of skin and the self inside the self. And how pleasurable it is, immersion in a lake of lavender, how like reversion into childhood's sun cream, zinc cream, ice cream. I soothe and spread, fingers breaststroke, easing years and lines from the wake I've sailed. Ringless Easter Island face, slips by, flaws soften and disappear, my mistakes filled with moisturizer. I touch and retouch inside the mirror, until smoother than a Henry Moore man, past is perfect, no angles, I'm an angel again, wings is visible as my history. I'll be reading mostly from the book here, The Blue Dressing Gown, and other poems. The Blue Dressing Gown is a poem that's been very good to me. It did win the Wenlock Festival Poetry Prize inside the Avon, so it was Carolyn Duffy, so that was kind of nice. It's part of a sequence, a sort of discontinuous narrative of poetry and a prose piece to do with my father, so I'll tell you the mini version of that story maybe a little bit later on. But I'll also read you some poems that aren't in the book. This is one I did write at Anna McCarrick. it just has the copyright symbol as the title. You have to see with the circle around it. That's called copyright. Well, it's not better when you can see. Xanadu, Innisfree, Elsinore are gone for poets evermore. Proofrock can also leave and eat his peach. Icebox plums can't be restolen in a certain red wheelbarrow then tipped over Dover Beach. Paradise is as lost as the inferno. Brooklyn Bridge is sold, as is love when blushed, then applied to a rose. The ball turret gunner will stay at peace. He will not be demeaned in death like that again. The state can rest. As that dread shape with Shakespeare's head and poetry's insatiable loins consumes the few metaphors left as it slouches on towards cool, it makes swans fly and honk at us below. Whose woods are these? I think I know. I've had a wonderful time in Ireland for the last 6 weeks. I've managed to get from Monaghan, of course, near Anna Carrick, and then to Dublin for a little, and Cork, and then to Galway, and then just lately up at Clifton, where I've come from today. Well, I was in Rome at the end of last year, and it should have been wonderful, shouldn't it? But it wasn't. It's a combination of the heat, I guess, of the tourists, among whom I was one, the hotel from hell, people trying to scam me and con me almost everywhere I went, even at the Trevi Fountain, the queues. So everything I was supposed to get, I didn't actually get from Rome. And so the only thing I did get from it was a poem. So I've got my Rome poem. So you've heard of Death in Venice. This is Death in Rome. I saw death in a square in Rome, quite near the Vatican, in fact. It was too hot for death, nearly 40 degrees, and the plaza swarming with passers-by, the scammers, scammed, and the damned, moving bee-like stall to stall, stopping to dip the proboscis into a pocket purse, then gelato. Poor death, in her black hoodie, black jeans, leather boots, with the silver straps attached, white makeup glistening, buds of sweat, half-moon eyeshadow below two black suns, was more like death warmed up than death. Death needed the coffin she climbed on to get her head above the ignorant crowd, leaning a bony arm on her scythe where plastic tape fluttered from the blade. Death had a black cape spread before her, but I was too far away, I was avoiding death, to see whether tribute was forthcoming. Customers seemed distracted by the present. Still, she was patient, looking blankly into the future, sitting down now and then to have a smoke on the coffin, elbows on knees, shoulders hunched. Death saw me during one of these smokos. I was cruising on the edge of the cosmos, pretending invisibility, even invincibility. But up looked Death, looked straight at me with a smile of recognition. I nearly spoke to Death then, but being shy by nature, superstitious, anxious, and not having Latin or Italian, and wondering anyway how an ordinary man can help Death, I hurried to St. Peter's for some beads I had to buy, some ceilings I had to see, some pomp and pain I had to witness before I died. Thanks, we're now happy Jude to Crest. I'll read you a couple of love poems. There's a section of love poems in the book. That's the section subtitled The Heart No Valentine, which is a phrase stealed straight from Billy Collins. The full quote is, "The heart, no valentine, decides to quit after lunch." to give you the flavour. But I'll read you a more romantic one to start off with. This is called With Her. With her, and at last she comes to bed, the blue nightie caught below her knees. And as she bends, like a girl picking flowers, her breast moves with the movement down, her hair falls to one side. There's a scent of rose and jasmine, and her night cream glows as she switches off the light and climbs towards me, while I wait in my singlet and skin with her useless book and glasses. Nearly 60, yet we slide beneath the sheet like children, slipping beneath the first wave of summer. And it's she who turns first to fold her hair before it's caught. So I turn to hold her, my palm floating across her back, pausing, then stroking again, like soothing something young and wild, shifting her thigh across mine, kissing her lips like a kiss before sleep, but it's really hollow. How are you tonight? And she sighs and says, this is nice. And our bodies move together like an answer. That's romantic. Faintly erotic. If, so if you want to be shocked, then you could pop out to the loo or something. Remember saying that in London when I was reading, and after I finished the poem, the largely women in the audience said, oh, is that all? So perhaps you won't be too shocked. It's called Oya Manaparam Lasanada, which is actually Sinhala, the language from Sri Lanka. It means how charming you are. It's in two parts, the poem, and the second part kind of undercuts the first one. One. Late into the next day, I could still taste you on the tips of my fingers and in my mouth. Or was it the food I'd cooked? Cumin, turmeric, paprika, mixed with your skin sheen, the scent of lotus. Smooth as temple water, you propped a cool head on one hand, pondering the prospect of a new lover. Night dissolved you into me and out, your clitoris a silk robe towards morning. Two. I'd never been someone's one-night stand before. After the heat, the phrase made me think of desert, with me as a distant cactus, green and awkward. I looked out the open window, a little cold now, one knee still on the bed, one arm shyly saluting your Alfa Romeo, as it waved, inscrutable in its plume of dust, some symbol of goodbye. It's an interesting poem to write because I had a choice, of course, about what sort of vehicle to put the woman in at the end. And I elected finally. The poem moved around quite a lot through drafts, I have to say. The car got to be very important until I lit on Alfa Romeo, which I'm kind of in love with. The poem reads very differently if you put her in a Beetle, for example. Or if you can imagine you put her in a pickup truck. Or a Range Rover, you know, I think it has to stay with Alfa Romeo or something. I read your jokey love poem now. This is, You've Moonwalked. You've moonwalked, leaving here full of space junk, moon charts in the kitchen, stars stuck to the ceiling. You have a lot to answer for, insomnia, lunacy, romance, striptease in slivers, then full of yourself, pulling that eclipse trick when you flick the light off and leave. No wonder NASA has photographed the phases of that turning face. No wonder I never know when you're here or away. Why, just now, on a too bright morning, when I was trying to set the day to rights, there you were, more blue than white, tagging along like a spell gone wrong. Yet when I turned to steady a thought, busy in orbit around my head. By the time I looked back, you'd begun to pack, just about to disappear again into the dark side of yourself. Oh, thank you. I don't know what's the etiquette here. Will people clap at the end or during? Either is fine. Thank you. I'd never heard of the term strabismic anxiety. Has anybody here? And you never won't know where poems come from. I mean, you're all poets here, so you know that they come from nowhere sometimes. I'm not particularly kind of a programmatic poet, so although the father poems certainly were a set of things I elected to write about, whenever I switched that part of my head on, another poem about him came out. So it can be like that. Other poems seem to come from nowhere at all, and for some reason, when I was at Bent and McCarrick, I discovered I wanted to know what the correct term was for that, having a wandering eye, you know, that you can't have both of your eyes completely focused. One eye can look on straight, the other one's inclined to take off as a child, and then you have to wear a patch to try and strengthen the eye, and so forth. So I don't know why this day I went on to Madame Google and discovered that strabismic amblyopia is the name of the term. But I got a poem. Strabismic sounds Polish, doesn't it, or Russian? Strabismic amblyopia is pretty much what you imagine. One of your eyes is born an alien. The brain, that hard driver, can't fuse contrasting images, so backs the straight one, and the turned or maligned eye, the stigmatized, the cane, the gypsy, the outcast, can't develop. And so is called names, like lazy, wandering, and sees the world aslant. While one fetches and carries, forages, hunts, and procreates in a straight line towards death, the other believes it can see through mirrors, around doors, beyond the clasp of hands, inside a heart, into a poem. It was exciting in childhood, especially after Saturday afternoon at the flicks, to compare the blink the wanderer produced with the tricks of Superman, feeling moments away from the gift of flight. Today, the two act more or less in tandem, one with a direct line to the imagination, the other helping with spelling, grammar, and punctuation. Last year in Sydney, I thought I had some poems waiting for me in a large cemetery down there. It's also to do with my ancestry. I was looking for people who'd come from Europe, as well as, of course, their great grandparents and so forth. So I went to Rookwood Cemetery, which turns out to be the largest cemetery in the Southern Hemisphere. It's of useless information. More than a million people are buried there. And I got three poems. This is one of them. It's called Questions for the Dead. By night, your necropolis could be a city skyline, neighbours on rooftops with TV antennas. By day, crucifixes chest piece their way through a thousand flocks of angels perched on marble or outside mausoleums, waiting for the world to end or one to wake. There's disorientation in being a lone searcher in a city of dead and gridlock streets. Inside the shrubs in patchwork plan, a million souls lie ready and waiting, like vehicles left in a stadium car park, motors running till the maps arrive. Religions intertwine like overlapping galaxies. Signs point uncertainly to chapels and shrines. So it's understandable that finding you and Kathleen, your stillborn grandchild, would be difficult, the helpful numbers well hidden behind trees and uncut grass. This time provides no grave goods to comfort either side of eternity, no clues as to who you were, a life with bookends, but no books. Birth, then death, drenched by the change, is the only story that made it here. Words wear fast, even with a headstone's gravity. Your sight turns out wordless, looking straight up into questions each day has to offer, and at night, the cartography of stars. Thank you. I'll read the Blue Dressing Gown, which is the title from of the book. Great. Were you jumping up to
No. Get
with the shepherd's crook?
No.
So it's part of a three-part sequence in the middle of this, what the publisher called the launch of this continuous narrative. So it's got numbers of poems and a prose piece, or a prose poem if you like. Making an effort to record some aspects of his life. So this is the third one called The Blue Dressing Gown. The short story is that he was an American serviceman who came to Australia, met and yes, did marry my mum. She was pregnant with me when he went back to be discharged to the States, but never came back, and he died quite young in San Francisco at 34. I've got some Irish background from Kentucky, a mixture of a cocktail of despair and alcoholism. And ironically, he died in a hotel called the Ferry Hotel, waiting to try and get a ship to get back to Sydney. And even more ironic than that was a place in San Francisco called the Embarcadero, which is built over the remains of 500 ships. So it's actually too poetic almost to use, Ferry Hotel, 500 ships, the man not able to take one, and so dying there. But some things were left in Australia, including a dressing gown and some pieces of documents, not a lot, a wallet. And so I decided to address that information a year or so ago, and this book is largely the result. So I might read a couple of poems from that and something lighter to finish, and that take me off. So this is The Blue Dressing Gown. It hung in my boy's wardrobe, an army regulation item no one could throw out. And it would be hard, wouldn't it, to discard the only thing left in something like the shape of him. It hung on a wire hanger, skeleton of his shoulder cutting across collarbone, the drape of it swinging side to side if nudged into a shy dance or if asked up by a breeze. I used to wear it with no sense of feeling weird or spooky, alternating with a practical flannel. Yet at night, sometimes woke, frightened by its doorway shadow, a man hanging on the moon's hook. I never realised I'd outgrown him, walking tall through one summer while his shoulders rode my back. The tassels swung like incense as I walked in his shape, trying to sense the being inside him.
Time for a few more.
Okay. Yeah, just let me know. You get a lot of stuff here sometimes. I know it's a generous amount of time. Thanks, Paul. I asked my mum, who's still alive, and it's been problematical actually writing it. She hasn't seen the whole book. And then, of course, she's curious. So one day she had a peek and then wished she hadn't, as it turned out. She opened up the prose piece in here is actually a work of imagination. Of course, we never met, he and I. But I've got the information about where and how he died in, because of a coroner's report and telegram. So actually, using Raymond Chandler's voice, or an adaptation of Raymond Chandler's voice, if you ever read the Philip Marlowe hardball detective stories, I thought you needed a pretty hard voice. And so I went back to the hotel where he died in imagination and met him then in the state of death. So that's in there. Unfortunately, that's the bit that she opened at. And realised why I advised her not to read it. But I did ask about when they first met, and at my aunt's place, and it was a very sweet conversation. And I remember her saying, she's 88 now, I remember her saying at the end, oh, it was passionate. So this is Contact 1942. Trying to tell me, words stop, as shoulders and hands attempt to remake him. Her face recording the shock, as though she turned a corner, opened a gift, opened her eyes, or had them opened by something amazing. In over 60 years, I have no experience of her to prepare for the way she is now. Not like the pleasure I've seen as she holds a grandchild, finishes a jumper, or demonstrates at 85 how to operate a DVD. Nothing. No reference for this moment as she tries again to explain, as though it was a kind of birth, something I can never understand. Now she almost groans with the memory of it. It was, she says, and tries to shape the waterfall of air in front of her into a man. I'll read you one about when I first discovered, it sounds kind of awkward to say it, or clunky to say it, that's a better word, when I didn't have a father. This is called at Haberfield Demonstration School. I was with the boys in our group at the meeting place, a peppercorn tree, eating lunch inside the shadows. The peppercorn's bright, spicy scent remains in memory the way it stays on fingers with the stain. Soon, I would be ready for the big school, separated from the girls' asphalt playground of rectangles, circles, and squares. Boys played wars up and down a sloping paddock beyond the classrooms. We heard the cries a continent away. Suddenly, the talk came to fathers and what they did. As turns edged around the circle like a clock, I discovered that I could not speak. What was it I could not say? The bell saved me as I was falling. A huge part of who I thought I was had avalanched, as if a shelf had dropped from a mountain. I was an obedient child, but I ran home from school then to Nan, my family skittled by a missing pin. We sat on her bed and looked at photographs and a face the size of a fingernail, Bill, from the war. She fanned out the pictures like playing cards. It was a summer's day. The bedroom's lace curtains glowed in tiny squares. Wind blew sweet scent from Pete Friend's biscuit factory. The bitumen noise of cars rushed down the street. A bit of lighten you up, I think. Very fond of washing, and also in the act of writing. I remember writing quite a serious poem. It was a Shakespearean sonnet, actually. It's in a book called Separation, about mine. It's nice to put it into a fully formed Shakespearean sonnet. At the same time I was doing it, I was doing some washing. It's something I like to do, actually. I think it's really nice, you know, you put things in dirty and that can act clean. And I found I was writing the dark poem of Separation, and then the other part of my psyche that's lighter and likes to have some fun was writing the other poem. So I was writing the two simultaneously. And so this is the lighter one. This is called In Praise of Washing. I like the sound of a machine washing, the pulse and hum, the snoring swash, the steady beat, the butterfly murmur of something being done, the clack of a completed cycle. I like the fairground thrill of clothes spinning, the vicarious excitement of domestic life possibly out of control, the blowhole in the sink, the cyclone in the hallway. I like the taking out and untangling of wet clothes, the soaking puzzle, the flap of a shirt or singlet rescued from drowning. I like the shaking, hanging, and pegging out of garments, joining others who bow their heads, then stand with arms upraised to hail the line with clothes, flags, prayers, or words, a day's offering to the wind and sun. Thank you. In 2007, I was introduced to this poem this way. I had an acrostic poem. You know acrostics, where you have the letters down here, and then you can tag some a word alongside each of the letters. So I had a TURP, a T-U-R-P. Now, TURP is actually a tertiary, a transurethral resection of the prostate. So just to show you that you get a poem from just about anything, I thought while I was lying there, waiting to get better, taking 2 weeks instead of 2 days, that I've got to get something out of this. So I wrote this poem called 8 Reasons to Have a TURP. 1. To improve your spelling. You can improve your own spelling and help others by clearly distinguishing between the often confused words prostate and prostrate. You reply, no, I'm actually having a transurethral resection of the prostate. I will be prostrate by the pool later. Clarifies the difference. 2. To increase your general knowledge and vocabulary. This development will come about as a result of exposure to new medical terms, such as catheter, void, catheter, double void, catheter, bladder spasm, and catheter. 3. To revitalize your expression, especially in the invention of curses, such as the Western unequivocal, may you be transfixed by 1,000 catheters. Or the Eastern, more metaphysical, may you never void. 4. To reduce anxiety in women, a simple badge worn on the lapel depicting a smiling prostate inside a red circle bisected by a red diagonal line communicates a clear message. 5. To provide an insight into sadomasochism. The procedure of prostate removal provides a chance to experience an S&M dungeon while in the safety of the hospital ward. Attention is on the penis, and there are procedures administered by women dressed up as nurses. The experience for most men is painful, possibly humiliating, but some could find it otherwise. 6. To find consolation in philosophy. One morning, you wake to discover an erection, but find it accompanied by a catheter. The experience is complex. You wish to show and tell, but this is not a matter for visitors or the nurse's bell. You'd like the erection to remain, but realise that for now it is of no practical use to anybody. Sensations are confused and provide a lively interior dialogue on relation of pleasure to pain, the rational to the sensual, the mind to the body, it to ego, themes often explored in philosophical discourse from Plato to Nietzsche. 7. To alter the self. The older self is left behind on a kind of psychic coat hanger at the nurse's station to be collected when you are discharged. For the duration of your stay in hospital, you are transformed into your new self, which in Australia, I have to say, is Dahl, or Dahls. Maybe love in England. What would be an island? What would we call you in a hospital? Love? Dahl? It's nice in an odd way, and a spontaneous affection sometimes makes you want to stay in hospital. 8. To reduce weight. The degree of weight loss depends on the size of the formerly enlarged prostate. Alright, will I wind up and...
Yep.
Have a note?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. I'll just do one on... Yep, on the end. Alright. I'll finish with a lighter one. This is one that I'm happy to do it by myself, but if you feel like joining in for the refrain, all you have to do is go 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. I mean, that would be nice, but don't worry, you don't have to. This is, I like to write ekphrastic poetry, which is poetry based on visual images. So I've written quite a lot of poetry based on paintings. And there's an Australian painter called John Brack who did a series of paintings on ballroom dances, kind of sending it up so the ladies fit them, and the colours are very bright, bright pinks and limes and so forth. Skirts all over the place and teeth like tombstones, smiling, you know that smile that they do. So one of them's called Ray and Judy. And I'll finish with this one. And thank you very much for both for having me here. Paul, it's been delightful to be at From the Mouth. I'm not going to, I'll struggle with the correct expression. And for you all for listening. Thanks. Ray and Judy. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Swoop across the old majestic. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Oh, good on you. Arch their backs, each spine elastic. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Crane their necks like drunken puppets. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Hiss foul oaths if someone stuffs it. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Curse the tart in flashy scarlet. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Bonking judges the bloody harlot. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Dear old Bert is nearly past it. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. That toupee looks like a ferret. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Keep alert from Frank from Dubbo. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Sinks contestants like torpedoes. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Ray's got something stuck in his front teeth. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Bits of tonight's meal of roast beef. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Young Brianna's eyes are popping. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. He snagged her skirt and held her stocking. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. If Jude's brass strap snaps now, they're cactus. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Bang goes all the weeks of practice. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. That's the waltz, the end of this lot. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. We've got the big one in the foxtrot. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Thank you. It's been great. Thanks very much.